So now it is my pleasure to introduce our speakers for our first presentation. So we will start with the University of New Mexico Superfund Research Center. We are joined by Dr. Angela Multandani, an assistant professor in the Department of Civil Construction and Environmental Engineering, Dr. Alicia Bolt, an assistant professor in the Department of Pharmaceutical Sciences, and Dr. Jose Serrato, an associate professor and Regents Lecturer in the Department of Civil Construction and Environmental Engineering, and is also the deputy director of the UNM Metals Superfund Research Center. So thank you all for being here today, and Dr. Serrato, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Brittany. It's an honor and pleasure for us to participate in this webinar. So we would like to share the vision for phase two of the UNM, University of New Mexico Metals Exposure and Toxicity Assessment on Tribal Lands in the Southwest. So this acronym stems for metals, of course, because that's what we have assessed for decades now with the group. So I really appreciate the opportunity to present on behalf of our center. So I am the deputy director now. Johnny Lewis is the director, but she retired from the University of New Mexico a year ago. So we are in the transition of leadership right now. So it is a very exciting moment for our center. And that's why, well, I decided to present today and also would like to feature some of our superstar investigators from the center. So Angela Multandani and Alicia Bolt, as were mentioned earlier. So we would like to thank the College of Pharmacy, the Superfund program, our colleagues in Stanford University, which we collaborate, the Southwest Research and Information Center, and of course, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences for the support. So why metals? The reality is that we have this legacy, and it depends on who you ask, they will give you different numbers. So this is a map that was assembled some time ago in collaboration with Johnny Lewis, Joe Hoover, and Deb McKenzie, which shows that about half of indigenous population is in 13 Western states in the U.S., where there are about 161,000 abandoned hard rock mines. And again, it depends who you ask, this number could be even higher. So there is traditional resilience on local resources. So of course, these resources are used for agriculture and other daily practices of the communities, including ceremonial. So these definitely can increase risk for exposure. So our goal is to advance the basic science needed to understand these relationships between metal mixtures and toxicity, and of course, complex because of the unique cultural context of our tribal community partners. And then understand through multidirectional communication and translation how culture and practice and all stakeholders can unite and really assess, you know, how these exposures, toxicity policy and interventions can be useful to develop new strategies for both risk assessment and risk reduction. So none of this would be possible, of course, without the invaluable support of our community partners. So these are just some pictures illustrating different community events that we have held over the years to listen to community concerns. And then this helps us to frame our questions and research so that it can be as responsible as possible to our community partners. So we are, of course, very honored, very thankful for these collaborations, and also very humbled, because if anything, I can tell you, I am always very humbled by how much I struggle communicating often, right, our Western science to our community. So it is definitely an iterative effort where I personally learn a lot. And the progress that we have made is based on some premises that I would like to expose here. So the first one is that we definitely have identified nanoparticles of uranium-bearing minerals, but of course, uranium doesn't occur alone. If you're a geologist, you know that there are many other elements that co-occur. And in our research, we definitely have detected at least the co-occurrence of uranium with vanadium, arsenic, and other metals, which constitute these mixtures, especially in solid samples. So in these solid samples obtained from mine waste, as you can imagine, are the ones that have the highest concentration. So And if you live here in the Southwest or you've visited, February and April, we get a lot of wind. So then we have identified airborne dust and weathering products that also have been transported, right? And then they contain these metal mixtures. And again, you know, these, not only have we detected that these metal mixtures occur, but many of them occur in particulate matter smaller than 2.5 microns, which is highly respirable. And then also, let's keep in mind that there is regulation for water, but we have no regulations for particulate matter. So this is an ongoing concern with our community. So also we have seen that plants associated with fungi can uptake uranium and arsenic. So we're looking at this as a means of understanding risk assessment, but also risk reduction through bioremediation. So on our biological projects, we have seen that there is minimal uptake of uranium ingested, so high exposure of intestinal immune cells, and we identified a new organ to target, which is the gut, and also we are very curious about the microbiome in the gut. So additionally, we have definitely identified, related to the environmental results that I presented earlier, that these airborne particles can be inhaled and exposed, to cause toxicity and health concerns. And we have, done some very nice work with our collaborators in the health sciences indicating, DNA damage and cardiovascular issues and other health outcomes that we are definitely interested on. And then also we have developed an appropriate culture and community planning with an intervention project called Thinking Sync, which is a very fascinating project that we have been thankful that the community communities have supported us with. And finally, we repeated biomonitoring in mulcher exposures to include, of course, these varying mixtures. So that's what we're trying to understand now in this second phase is in more detail, this episodic event. So, and of course, there are still concerns with immune dysregulation and with, of course, COVID-19 susceptibility and susceptibility. So finally, the specific aims for our phase two is first to understand the mechanisms for these metals and metal mixtures and their systematic immune responses, indirect modulation, and environmentally relevant processes that could affect the risk assessment and risk reduction. So second would be the development of interventions built in AIM-1, but that are based, of course, on culturally respectful practices so that we can, again, focus on reducing these risks and informing our communities with respect to how we design our biological and environmental studies. So this is a bi-directional information, as I said before. Then we continue to ensure strong translation and communication with our partners to hopefully drive decision makers, clinicians, and other stakeholders to make decisions. And finally, bringing together diverse institutions in a broader range of indigenous communities so that we can inform our team science and training. So this is a beautiful image that my good friend Mallory Kotsauki, who is the artist of our group, made for us. And it illustrates how our group comes together with these different biomedical and environmental projects to assess a holistic view that is culturally respectful, and also we are trying to make sure to continue to build trust, because that is definitely our target and our responsibility, and that can only be done by spending time and effort on these relationships. So we do have this course, so the community engagement, the trainee, which is a key part, of course, of our center, and finally our administrative core and our data management and analysis course. So I will pass it now to Anjali Molchandani, who will talk about our environmental projects.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for being here today. My name is Anjali. I am the co-lead for one of the environmental projects, and I'll be talking about both of them today. So if you could take us to the next slide, Jose, just to kind of ground you on where you are, I want you to direct your eyes to the bottom half of your screen, We have two environmental science and engineering projects. The first is PM, which stands for particulate matter. Here we're looking at particulate matter in dust, the concentration, characterizing it, and looking at uptake into agriculture. And then on the left-hand side, we have ESE REMED, which stands for remediation, which then looks at how we can clean up the uranium, arsenic, vanadium, or other abandoned mine waste. So if you could take us to the next slide. So our goals with our environmental projects are threefold. The first is to assess how much and characterize the metals that are present in several different parts of the mine, the waste, the soils inside and outside the mine, and then the air that blows in the dust coming off of these mines. When we can then understand how much of these metals are present or the characteristics of those metals, we can then go to the next step, which is looking at whether these metals are taken up by agricultural products. The communities that we partner with, such as Laguna Pueblo or the Navajo Nation, are heavily relying on agriculture, such as corn, as their primary industry. So here we want to look at whether these metals are taken up and whether these food products are safe to eat. And then finally, we want to look at how we can clean up these mine waste. So we're looking at naturally available materials and processes like limestone or like bioremediation for cleaning up water, soils, or waste. Thank you, Sose. So on this slide, I want to talk about how we are co-creating knowledge with our community partners. We are creating research questions hand in hand with community partners. And as we come up with research results in the lab, we are finding new creative ways to take those results back to the community to continue to answer their questions and create new questions. So starting in the top left, this here is an image of collecting samples with our community partners. When we take those samples back to the lab, we then characterize whether those metals are taken up by, say, plant roots, shoots, or fruits. In the middle top, you can see this is an image that was created by September Benson looking at concentrations that are present in different parts of the plant. In the bottom right, this is a color by numbers image that was created by Kirena Sosi, in which we can then talk to kids of different ages about where metals are present in their communities. We then have art that was created by our artist in residence, Mallory Kathaki, and those are the two images in the bottom. The bottom left is an image of Laguna Pueblo, the high cliffs. You can see the dust particles that are suspended in the air, and that represents metals in the dust. And at the bottom, we have phytoremediation depicted by these flowers, looking at natural processes to clean up the metals. In the bottom center, this is an image called extraction and remediation that again is talking about legacy extraction of uranium and then phytoremediation or other natural processes bringing hope to our lands. And in the top right, we're looking at air sampling, so how we can collect dust samples and understand metals in the dust, which takes me to the next slide, please, Jose. And our first environmental project, which is ESE, Environmental Science and Engineering, Particulate Matter. And this is led by Adrian Brearley, Eliana Lai, and Joe Galuski. Next slide, please. The goals of this project are to evaluate the transport and bioavailability of uranium-bearing minerals in waste, soils, and airborne particles associated with mines. As Jose mentioned, during the first part of the Metals Center, we were looking at characterizing the dust particles, and we found nanoparticles of uranium in these dusts. So now what we want to do is understand whether these uranium particles are taken up by agriculture. And then finally, combining both of those two aims and looking at historical dust transport and depositional processes and pathways and seeing how that is going to impact agricultural lands near these abandoned mines. Our second environmental project is ESE remediation. This here is co-led by Jose, myself, and Jennifer Rogers. Next slide. Here we are looking at bioremediation using naturally available plants and fungi. So these are root-associated fungi or endophytic fungi. During phase one of metals, we found that root endophytic fungi could help mobilize metals within the fungi and on the roots of plants and actually help these plants grow even more abundantly. So we want to take that work further and look at mechanisms that underlie the interaction between these fungi and plants that are naturally already growing at or outside of the mine. and then create bioreactors that would then manipulate temperature, humidity, or use naturally available waters that would be present at the mine to see whether these plants continue to grow as they would, or what conditions we could maybe use them in to work on remediating the metals in these mines. Next slide. That takes us to our biomedical projects, and I will hand this off to Alicia Bolt. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's so nice to be here with you today. My name is Alicia Bolt. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Pharmaceutical Sciences in the College of Pharmacy here at UNM, and I'm going to highlight our biomedical projects that we have in our center. Next slide, please. So again, to orient you back to this beautiful image that really illustrates how all of the center interacts with each other to really answer the question of how is exposure to this mine waste and the metal mixtures that are found there affecting human health and also affecting the environment. And so the biomedical projects are really centered on looking at two important routes of exposure. You can see here in the middle of our slide, we have inhalation. So we're focused on the lungs, and we call that bioproject lung. And then this is a new project that really arose from community concerns, but also from the work that the environmental projects did to really identify nanoparticles of these metals that are present in the environment, and that could be a very important route of exposure that we weren't looking at in phase one of the Superfund. And then the second biomedical project is looking at the gut. And again, we were really interested because of looking at how does oral exposure to these metals affect our immune system in what ways. And what we found during that first phase was that we really saw that there was a high concentration of these metal mixtures that were actually staying in the intestines and not being absorbed systemically. And so that really shifted our focus to looking at immune dysregulation in the gut instead of more systemically in places like the spleen or the bone marrow. And so that project really has gotten some very exciting data from phase one that is now building into phase two. And then the third biomedical project is called BP Community or BPCOM. And I feel that really ties together some of these other two routes of exposures, because this is really focused on looking at health effects in these communities that are exposed to these heavy metals mixtures and trying to understand how exposure can play a role in disease, but also understanding how exposure is happening. When is it happening? What routes of exposure and what types of metals? Next slide, please. So the goals of the biomedical projects first are to really evaluate human exposure levels and how living near in proximity to this mine waste affects exposure. And as Jose mentioned during the initial introductory slides, we've seen some very interesting episodic exposures. And so one of the main emphases of this phase two is to really understand why is some people getting exposed to metals only for a day or two, and then it goes back down and then it increases again. So what's happening there? What is their life like? What is their exposure routes like during those times of high exposure, and being able to drill down to what's going on so that we can hopefully understand what exposure is and then also how to model that better in our studies. Second goal is to assess how exposure to abandoned uranium mine waste affects human health. And one of the focuses that we've been focusing on even since phase one was really looking at immune dysregulation. And this is mainly because of community concerns again, and seeing increased levels of autoimmune diseases in these communities, but also because we understand mechanistically that metals such as arsenic can cause immune suppression. And so how do these metals mechanistically drive this and lead to immune dysregulation? And then understanding how these metal mixtures can work together to reprogram the immune response that can contribute to diseases like autoimmunity or cancer. Next slide. Again, we'd like to highlight some of the ways that we have communicated to the community and worked with the community to answer questions and provide answers back to the community. And so in our top left here, I really love this image. This is an image of a handout that we had used to start asking and discussing health questions with community members during our community events. So getting people to start thinking about what kind of concerns do they have about exposure to this mine waste, and what are the things that they really want to know when it comes to their health. In the center here, you can see multiple pictures of community events where we have listening sessions or information sessions with our community partners during the feast days, where we can go in and have these handouts and start generating conversations. And then another way that we have really effectively been able to work with our communities is through art, as we've talked about. So in the right here, this is actually one of our UNM students from the Laguna Puebla, one of our partnering communities. And he is working with our projects, with a lot of our environmental projects, to look at what are the negative effects of this mine waste on his own land. And he has been, here is some artwork that he has provided that really reflect how he feels about the exposures and the risks that are associated with that and how it's affected him and his community. And then in the bottom left-hand side here is some more beautiful artwork by Mallory Kotaki. The first image is really showing how these metals, such as arsenic and uranium, can cause DNA damage and break apart that DNA. And then a lot of the exciting work that has been done in phase one, looking at the role of zinc to be able to mitigate those that damage. And you can see here, the zinc is these blue balls that are representing re-threading of the DNA strand and sewing it back together to health and restoration. And so again, this has been a very effective way to be able to really communicate what's going on at a level that people can really resonate with. Next slide. So the first biomedical project is BP Lung, and it is initiated by myself, as well as Catherine Zykowski, Sarah Blossom, and Matthew Campin. Next slide. So this project, like I mentioned, is really evaluating how exposure to these metal mixtures and these particulate forms of that specifically, and it contributes to immune dysfunction and the development of autoimmunity. And if you look at the image here on the right, you can see that we're really interested in two major mechanisms. We're looking at activation of immune responses within the lung after inhalation, and we're interested in looking at changes in the NLRP3 inflammasome activation. And we're also interested in understanding better how neutrophils can become activated, forming these extracellular traps or nets, and how this can be contributing to this immune dysregulation that can lead not only to lung diseases, which we see also increased incidence of in these communities, but also autoimmunity and looking at different systemic endpoints as well. And so we're planning on doing this in multiple ways, looking at using high throughput co-culture models in vitro to be able to really look at mechanisms, and then also be able to model that in a mouse model, where we can look to see if inhalation exposure to these metal mixtures can lead to the development of immune dysregulation and autoimmune endpoints. And then finally, in AIM-3, we're really interested in going back and looking at communities that are heavily exposed to these metal mixtures to see what is the evidence of inhalation exposure to these metals, and is it leading to changes in airway inflammation that could potentially be leading to these outcomes, to be able to start addressing, is this an exposure route that's important to be looking at in these communities? Next slide. The second project is called BP Gut, so focusing on oral exposure to these metals, either through food or through the drinking water. And this project is led by Eliseo Castillo, Julie In, and Fredin Coing. Next slide. So this project is really looking at investigating the impact of ingestible metals on the gastrointestinal tract. And as I mentioned, we really saw the high concentrations of both arsenic and uranium in the gut. And so how is this affecting inflammatory pathways? Is it affecting metabolism? Is it affecting the microbiota of the gut? And so if we're looking at the right-hand side of this image, you can see that the first aim is really going back to a mouse model and looking at how does oral exposure to these metal mixtures play a role in altering that intestinal system, either by changing the microbiota, changing the intestinal epithelial cells, and also altering the immune cells that are found there that can play an important role in systemic immunity. In AIM-2, they're going to use gut organoids, which allows them to be able to really model inter-individual variability and response, because they'll have different human gut organoids that they can use, and they can look at characterizing changes in the gut following these metal mixture exposure using high throughput techniques such as single cell RNA-seq, as well as functional assays. And then in the third aim, similar to BP Lung, they are planning to have health studies again, where they're being able to now look to see what exposure is coming from the gut by looking at feces samples and trying to better characterize what are immune dysregulation changes that are occurring through gut and how is the gut being changed. Next slide. And then the final biomedical project is called BP Community. And this is led by Lori Hudson, Deborah McKenzie, Jim Liu, Esther Erdi, as well as Erica Dashner-Titus, in collaboration with our community engagement team that's led by Chris Shuey and his members in the Southwest Research Center, Paul Robinson, Sarah Hanoi Adike, and Rose Dan. Next slide, please. And this project, I think, really brings together the rest of the other two biomedical projects to really initiate health studies, including biomonitoring and analysis of biomarkers in heavily impacted communities, and really facilitating the health studies that are being proposed in both BP Lung and BP Gut. And so they're really trying to look at understanding how these metal mixtures are, how people are being exposed through biomonitoring, and then also looking at outcomes of oxidative stress, inflammation, and immune dysregulation, and how that is associated with exposure. And then aim two is really more digging into those mechanisms of understanding how are these metal mixtures leading to enhanced oxidative stress, inflammation, as well as DNA damage, and how the information that we now know about zinc and the importance of zinc in counteracting these effects can we mitigate these exposures through either dietary antioxidants or other metal micronutrients like zinc and be able to protect these communities. Next slide. So with that, I'd like to end, and I'd like to thank the huge team of people that are part of the UNM Metal Superfund Center and all of their contributions to this work, both in phase one. And we are very excited about starting phase two and the momentum that we're feeling, and we're really excited to be here, and we'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Alicia, for such a nice closure. And I just want to also close, of course, again, acknowledging our collaborators, the Pueblo of Laguna and in Navajo Nation, Redwater Pond Road, Lugap Tachi and Cameron. We're also developing other additional collaborations with other communities. So we're excited about that. And, you know, you mentioned Sarah Henio Adikai, which I just want to feature very quickly, stating that she made a very nice, like dictionary, if you want to name it, right, of how we translate our Western science words to Navajo and back and forth. So that this effort is very valuable because there are no words in Diné for uranium, for example. Diné is Navajo. So we're trying to develop this synergy. So I really appreciate the input from everyone. So any questions, we'll be happy to take.
Thank you so much, Jose, Alicia, and Anjali, for that excellent presentation. There are a couple of questions that have come in through the Q&A pod. So as a reminder to everybody that has called in, you can put your questions through the Q&A pod because the chat is going to be disabled for anybody that's not a panelist. So the first question that came in was, I believe was at the beginning when you were talking about the vegetables that uptake this uranium and arsenic. So are those vegetables that are exposed to contamination sold? And if not, are those vegetables managed?
Yeah, so this is Jose. Just very quickly, you know, we have this fascinating project. In COVID, this came in, same question came from the community, you know, are vegetables contaminated? So we did this a sampling and analysis campaign. What we found was that actually the community practices are very well taken care of avoiding the contamination because they know how to use soils and waters that are not contaminated, and we weren't able to detect any contamination. So it's actually very good news for the community and for their agricultural activities, and shows the resilience of just traditional knowledge on really overcoming some of these challenges. So I guess not every research finding that we report has to be negative, right? So it's very nice when we can report positive things to the community, but definitely the Pueblo of Laguna has a protocol for determining how to control, you know, then how agricultural practices are trained and developed, and also going to the sales. So I would develop to them to really answering what they do, but wanted to share this experience where we as a center collaborated to verify that at least on what we have analyzed, we really haven't seen concern, let's say, on elevated concentrations on these crops.
Thank you. Another question came in asking, does the immunology research have an epidemiological study component in your community?
Alicia, do you want to give it a shot?
So definitely for BP community, yes, there is definitely an epidemiological component to that, looking at health outcomes in the communities. We have multiple epidemiologists that are part of our team, and looking at associations between exposure to these metal mixtures and health outcomes in these communities. And then also bedded and threaded into the other biomedical projects are also looking at some of those more epidemiological questions.
And then from the same person, another different comment and question. The artist renderings are great, and the graphic of zinc sewing of the DNA back together, for example, is beautiful. Is your artist, is your artist a member of a local tribe? And how does your artist develop graphics to best communicate with the communities?
So let me answer that question, but I will ask Anjali also to jump in. So first of all, Mallory is funny because she used to, work with us so closely for some time now. And we have some slides where we call her artist in residence. I saw that, but she is now a permanent staff person in different centers that we have with our environmental health program. So Mallory Kochak is from the Zuni tribe, which is great because she has that context and also I'm going to call it a knowledge to help us bridge these gaps, where we sometimes as scientists think how clearly we speak, but we really don't. And it has been really incredible how, Mallory is not only with the art giving us feedback, but also, sometimes like a peer reviewer, very tough, saying, this is too up there, guys. You have to find a way of communicating this more clearly. And I really appreciate that, so that's why I wanted to ask Anjali, because they are both collaborating in a science communication effort. And Anjali, if you can elaborate more about the collaboration with Mallory Kwetsauki, I will really appreciate your insights.
Yes, for sure. So one thing about Mallory is that she is also a scientist and a biologist. So she comes with that biology training as well as her traditional knowledge that will help kind of blend both of those to create these wonderful art pieces. But since Mallory is only one person and we have so many awesome projects within this center that we want to communicate, we have created a pilot program in which we are partnering with local community members, our trainees, and then our researchers to create these triads or teams in which we can create new art pieces or communication pieces to take back to our communities. And in this sense, we can work with different tribes that we work with and have them talk to us about the concerns that they have or symbols that they use to communicate certain features. And then we can work with our trainees and our scientists to put together newer art pieces to talk about the projects that we have in development right now. So that's a project that is kicking off this summer and this fall.
That's great. Okay, so the next question that came in is, could you please tell us about the cytotoxicity data if you have any?
So I can address that at least initially. I'm curious what types they're specifically asking about, but I can say that, it's interesting. Uranium itself is not super cytotoxic if you're looking at it from the standpoint of cell death. But it has been shown to be able to induce DNA damage in certain contexts and to have other cellular alterations. What's interesting, though, is that when you look at it in mixtures, and oftentimes, we don't see uranium alone. We see uranium in combination with arsenic. And so arsenic, on the other hand, has been very well established to be cytotoxic and can kill cells at the micromolar range or some, and also to lead to DNA damage and inductions of inflammatory processes in different cell types. And so oftentimes our work is really more focused on understanding how does uranium play a role in combination with arsenic as well as other metals. And so that's some of the work that now we are working on in this phase of the Superfund.
Thanks, Alicia, for that. Okay, the next question that came in is, are there changes in the gut flora following exposure to these metals?
That's another great question. We are working on that right now. So hopefully we will, in BP lung, BP gut, they'll be able to answer that question soon. They are currently working on that and looking at changes in the biodiversity of gut bacteria that is found with and without exposure. And so that's hopefully something that we'll be able to report on the next time we have an update.
Awesome. And then a comment came in, very great presentation, loved all the speakers. So thank you for that comment. The next question that came in was, what happens to the contaminants when they're, which have been taken up in the plants near mines during wildfires?
So I'll take a shot at that. This is Jose Serrato. So I have been working, and I know Matt Campen too, and others in the UNM Metal Superfund Center on wildfires. So interestingly, you know, this is a key question because there wouldn't be any mining if you didn't have naturally occurring metals in your geology in the first place. Right. So what we see here in the Southwest is in many of our sites that are, let's say, rich in metals, just naturally, the plants and trees that grow close to these places accumulate these metals. And also you have to remember that when you have a wildfire, you burn these trees, you volatilize the organic matter. But what we have seen is that metals are concentrated through this process in the ash. So we do have a lot of projects trying to understand this energy. I know Matt Campen has an R1 working on this from the toxicological standpoint. And I have been looking at this more because I am very curious about the chemistry of the ash. And I have published some papers on this that I'll be happy to share if you follow up. But this is an interesting question because of how rich geologically this region is with metals. You know, we definitely have to follow up on really understanding then what are the risks from this particular matter that are generated during wildfires, like the Hermit's Peak fire that we just had here about a year ago, the, you know, biggest fire in the history of New Mexico. So I guess there's a lot of openness in answering that question, but we definitely can tell you that we have been trying to address this concern.
Thanks, Jose. And we have a ton more questions coming in. We only have time for a couple more before we have to move to the next presentation. So we'll try to get through these. And if we don't get through them, either the presenters can answer in the chat or in the Q&A pod as the during the next throughout the rest of the presentations, and then or they can answer them offline. So the next question is for the in vitro gut. And what are the biofluids that you will use? And they have in there also, and the lung.
So for the lung biomedical project, we are interested in looking at exhale breath condensate, as well as looking at nasal swabs to be able to look at inflammatory mediators within the airways, as well as oxidative stress markers. And then for the BP gut, they're mostly looking at feces. And then in the BP community, they're going to be also collecting urine and blood. And so we will be able to kind of look at not only routes of exposure, but also looking at systemic exposure and excretion pathways to really understand total body burden and what is happening systemically versus more at these specific organ targets.
Alicia. And the next one is great presentation and excellent work underway. Regarding the finding of sporadic episodic exposures, have you considered using ethnographic research to document quotidian life ways among community partners? And would that be a culturally appropriate form of research among your partners?
So thank you for that question. I want to feature my good friend Thomas Dupree, who is playing an important role in translation. So with this, what I would suggest, Thomas, is definitely there has to be a very conscientious effort on determining how exposures relate to daily activities. And the way that, you know, our tribal partners live is very different in context to where regulators live in Washington, D.C. sometimes. And we really need to be very aware of this reality. So Johnny Lewis and others have been working for a long time on refining how these exposure models can be catered to these realities that we live here. And that's an excellent point, Thomas, that is a work in progress for our center. And I would encourage all of our partners and people who are listening today to be conscientious and aware about this, right? That the rules that we come up in an office in Washington, D.C. or New York City or wherever it is are not going to be the same as they are here.
Thank you, Jose. And unfortunately, there's in the interest of time, we're going to have to move on to the next presentation. There's a couple more questions in the pod. So if you guys want to go ahead and answer those, that'd be great. And thank you again, Dr. Serrato, Bolt, and Mulchandani for that great presentation.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
And our next presentation is from the Columbia University Northern Plains SRP Center. We're joined by Dr. Ana Navas Acien, Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health and the Director of the Columbia University Northern Plains SRP Center. Also, Dr. Steve Chilrod, the Lamont Research Professor at Lamont Doherty Earth Observation of Columbia University, and is the co-director of the center and the principal investigator of Project 1 and a co-investigator in Project 5. And lastly, Ray O'Leary, a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa and public health analyst with Missouri Breaks Industries Research Inc., who leads Columbia's Community Engagement Corps. Dr. Navas Acien, thank you for being here, and to the rest of your crew that's here as well. I will now turn it over to you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Brittany. And it's a real honor to follow the UNM Metals Superfund Research Program. And I am together with Ray O'Leary and Steve Chilrod. We are very privileged to present the work of our new Superfund Research Program, the Columbia University Northern Plains Center. So the goals of our center are to advance science, technology, and to leverage traditional knowledge to protect the Northern Plains water resources and communities from hazardous metals exposures. And the logo of our center, which was put together by indigenous scientists, artist Tammy Granados, represent the water resources, the Missouri Basin, in the Northern Plains states, protected by the medicine wheel from the Lakota people. So the motivation for this center, this is a new center that we are just starting. We are very excited. And the motivation comes from the sobering data of the epidemic of cardiovascular disease and diabetes that indigenous communities in the Northern Plains suffer. In North Dakota and South Dakota, American Indians have the highest rates of coronary heart disease of the US, and over one third of the deaths occurred before the age of 65 years. Moreover, the diabetes burden is 300 times higher than in white communities. We need to recognize that this epidemic of cardiovascular disease and diabetes are in great part related to European colonization and US policies. But also we need to recognize that sovereignty, cultural resilience, and traditional knowledge are core values in the Northern Plain communities and remain strong with very positive influences. Given this epidemic of cardiovascular disease and diabetes affecting the Northern Plains and many other indigenous communities across the United States, it's really important to identify and recognize the role that environmental exposures have in these epidemics. And data from the Strong Heart study which is the longest and largest study of cardiovascular disease in American Indian communities across the US, with data from the Northern Plains, the Southwest, and also the Southern Plains, has clearly shown that arsenic exposure is a risk factor for disease. Very clear trends for how arsenic is related with cardiovascular disease and how it impacts diabetes. Many other outcomes have been associated with arsenic in the Stronghart study, including several cancers, lung function, kidney disease. So these exposures are often, arsenic exposure is often naturally occurring, but as it was discussed following the great presentation from Jose Serrato and team, and by looking at this map that Johnny Lewis put together to represent the mining exposures across the many parts of the country are particularly affecting indigenous communities. And this mining has contributed to arsenic exposure, also as shown by the UNM Metals Group, as well as to uranium exposure. So this combination of mining and together with naturally occurring, and naturally occur, it's naturally occurring, this is why there is mining going on there, is can be reflected in community water systems data. And this is something very important in this map that some of our group members, our Superfund Center investigators and NIAGRA team put together. You can see how many community water systems across the western part of the US are affected by uranium arsenic in the water. And this is particularly important in the Northern Plain communities. And however, we know quite relatively little about the long-term health effects of these exposures through the drinking water. If we go a little bit more in depth to one of our communities that we are working with in the Northern Plains, you can see in this map how each of these dots reflects a house, a family. And the color of the map reflects the levels of either arsenic or uranium or together when they are above of the MCL. So arsenic and uranium in red is above of the maximum contaminant level for both elements. And this is reflects a substantial exposure day after day of the life of these people from when children are born during pregnancy, when they are born, as they grow as older as adults, in the elderly, this is a daily dose of exposure to these toxic elements. With for some of them, especially for uranium, relatively little information on the long-term health effects. And also relatively little knowledge of why is it are the exposure there and what is the contribution from the mining versus the naturally occurring component. So because of these reasons, the widespread exposure, the impact, the potential impact of mining, and the long-term questions about the long-term health effects, including both the past exposures and the current exposures. We put together several organizations came together to develop this new Superfund Research Center, and including Missouri Breaks, that you'll get more to hear more from Ray O'Leary in a minute. The Stronghart study, our partnering population-based cohort study that we've been working on for a long time, as well as investigators from multiple organizations across Colombia, the Milman School of Public Health, the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, and the Columbia Climate School. And together we have developed this center that has five projects, with project one developing high-resolution models of groundwater metal exposures with the goal to be able to predict at a very fine scale when there is going to be water contamination. In project two, our goal is to use isotope metallomics as tracers for the sources and the cycling of metals. Can we address the question that our communities have of where, why do I have metal? Why do I have uranium in my drinking water? Is it because of the mining? And then in our projects three and four, we leverage epidemiological research together with mechanistic in vivo research to answer the, about understand the health effects of these exposures, arsenic and uranium primarily, with finally in Project 5, close the circle and be able to provide and support new interventions for sustainable addressing the problem of water contamination for metal mixtures. So this work in the Northern Plain communities could not take place without the key role that the community engagement core has to make the science and this collaboration possible. So now I would like to let Ray O'Leary join us and describe the work that the community engagement and their implications in all the projects is taking place. So Ray, please go ahead.
Thank you, Anna. So you can see here that Missouri Breaks is located throughout South Dakota and North Dakota, which the Missouri River conveniently goes through. We have a variety of office locations. Our main office where I'm located is on the Cheyenne River Reservation in South Dakota. And then we have another office on the Spirit Lake Reservation in North Dakota. We have a more urban location in Rapid City. And then we also cover the Pine Ridge Reservation with our research projects. So we cover the Dakotas there. And I think what makes our Superfund community engagement work unique is that our community engagement partner, which is Missouri Breaks, is located, you know, in the communities. We are staffed by tribal members. We are, you know, the people that we're collecting water samples from our relatives and our neighbors. We have a unique advantage, I think, to really make the most out of the partnership with our community partners, since we have those local relationships. You can see it with Missouri Breaks, our logo is, above it is our vision, which is creating opportunities for health. And really we, you know, we can't make people be healthy, right? But we can create the opportunities. So I love that this Superfund research project, you know, has the potential with that Project 5 to, you know, give a an instrument that can potentially remediate the heavy metal contaminants in our water. Next slide, thank you. So as Anna mentioned, this Strong Heart study is really the what this Superfund research project surrounds. And Missouri Breaks has been involved with the Strong Heart study since the 90s. You can see from the visual here that there's been a variety of ancillary studies as well as other studies that aren't related to Strong Heart study that have come out of the original phases of the Strong Heart study. We are currently in phase 7, and all of the studies that have a red circle around them indicate studies that have some level of environmental component. So initially that was really not a focus of the Strong Heart study or the other studies that Missouri Breaks works on, but you can see in more recent years that's become a pretty prominent theme to some of our research. The Strong Heart study is most known for of course, being the, as Anna said, the longest and largest cardiovascular study of American Indian health. And one thing that I think is important to note is our 90 or greater than 90% retention rate. And I think the reason that that's so high is because, you know, we are from the community. We've been here since the 90s and have established a great relationship and trust within within the community over the last 30 years. And in the next slide, you'll see some examples of past community engagement work that Missouri Breaks has done. In the top left is a photo of Ben and Marcia from Missouri Breaks, and Ben from Columbia, meeting with tribal organizations and key partners in the community to better understand the needs and priorities and get feedback on our entire process. And that's something that we've repeated these meetings on all of the reservations we're working with all of the key partners, to really make sure that we're being respectful of their needs. I can share that one concern of some of the tribal partners and water organizations is leaking information in a bad way about contaminated water. They've all been through that before where things have not been handled as carefully as they should have been. And all of a sudden the community's in an uproar over information that the water is bad. So I think that's where Missouri Breaks, I really see our role coming in, is making sure that we're doing it in a good way, in a way that all of our partners are comfortable with as well. So we don't create any hysteria, but solutions, right? And information and understanding of how we can move forward in a good way. You can also see some examples of our community engagement where we'll just go to community events and talk to the community about what we already know about environmental health and what their concerns are in the future. And in the center photos, you can see some of our work with youth, both in their high school science projects, as well as a symposium where we can do hands-on activities with the youth. And a lot of our community engagement work that we'll be moving forward with will be using the Chunlee Tobacco Coalition's framework in the picture there. And this shows kind of the intersection of education and policy change in tribal communities as community engagement. So there's a full webpage that I'll drop in the chat when I'm done presenting that you can check out. But this framework will kind of drive how we move forward with the community engagement core. And in the next slide, you can see some of our Missouri Breaks staff. There were presentations just here a couple of weeks ago, right in Pine Ridge and Cheyenne River, on what we know so far and where we're going with this project. And so this is some of our staff here. And I would say the presentations were very well received. I think the community is very eager to learn from this study and potentially have solutions in the end. And you can also see some of our team collecting water samples that just started here in the last couple months as well. And it's very community driven. All of our staff are local and again, neighbors and relatives to those we're working with. So yeah, I think that's it for me.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ray, so much. Steve.
Yes. Hi. So I'm Steve Sugar, right? I'm a geochemist. And I've been associated with one SRP center or another since I was a postdoc. So I feel like my whole professional career has been growing up with the Superfund research program. And I have to say that our new project is the most integrated of the Superfund research programs that I've been associated with in the past. And so I'm really proud of our current program. So project one is all about understanding the concentrations in the groundwater, and then using that information in different ways. So and the first thing we need to do is increase the data density, because of all the past history that you've heard about in both the first presentation and now, there's just a very small amount of data on the tribal lands. And so that's our first aim. And that's to help us characterize the factors that control the distribution of arsenic and uranium in the groundwater and differentiate factors that mobilize arsenic and uranium. And we need that information so that we can develop the groundwater models. And our goal is not to just develop a groundwater model, but to have it be a model that can really predict at the 60 to 100 meter scale where clean water is versus where water is contaminated, which will really help people understand where they can drill, which is an expensive process to get clean water. And then, whoops, go back one. And then the third aim is to use that information to estimate long-term arsenic and uranium exposures for the Project 3. Go ahead. So a little bit more about the prediction model. We're using a machine learning model, a random forest model, and those can often be black boxes. But our overarching premise to our approach is that the best models should be grounded in a mechanistic understanding of the geochemical processes that control the water quality. And if you really need to predict at a fine spatial scale, well, then your models need predictor variables that are actually available at that fine spatial scale. there are a lot of models out there that have 179 variables in their prediction, but most of those variables are not available. Here, we're looking at remote sensing as one of the few data sets that really provides complete data at a fine spatial scale. And flooding frequency and flooding duration were the master variables that were used in the creation of this model, which was originally created in Cambodia, in the deltaic areas of Cambodia. And now we're applying this model up in the Northern Plains. And it actually, applying a model that was trained and validated in Cambodia, is doing an okay job in the Northern Plains. But we want to do better. And so a lot of our effort is going to be focused on that. Next slide, please. So project two. So project two is a very novel project. As Anna said, it's using isotopes as tracers for looking at the sources and cycling of not only the uranium and the selenium, but also the arsenic. And its premise is to look at the spatial distribution of these isotope ratios, which are called isoscapes, similar to how you look at a topographic map. And you would have this information showing where the highs and lows in the different isotopes are. And that would tell you a lot about what's going on in the ground as far as the redox cycling and the transport of those elements. But they're also going to look at them in the urine of the cohort. And there they really hope to develop these novel biomarkers of the uptake and cycling of these redox-sensitive metals in the body and be able to validate those through the animal model in Project 4. Next slide, please. So I'm going to skip this for time so we can go on to the next slide. So Project 5 is the last kind of geochemical project. And it's really focused on trying to develop treatment systems that are effective and long-lasting and sustainable by leveraging what's already in the water, which are the natural constituents, including the microbes, and use those to produce the iron oxide media that is very useful for taking out the contaminants, but also recycle them so that they can last for a really long time. The next aim is really focused on enhancing the treatment through photocatalysts to change the arsenic and the uranium into the forms that are easier to remove. And that means for uranium to make them into the oxic form, while in the arsenic to make them, I'm sorry, in the uranium to make them into the reduced form, and in the arsenic to make them into the oxic form. And the third aim is to develop a drinking water quality monitor that will provide automated information to the user to know when their water is clean and good, or to know when it really does need some maintenance. So many of the water treatment systems that are out in everyone's homes around the country are put there and then forgotten and are no longer treating the water, and sometimes even making the water worse. And then our final point about this project is we really have a major translational goal that to be prepared to commercialize the products we're beginning, and to do that in collaboration with NBIRI and community members, to not only transfer capacity and knowledge, but to develop jobs and to develop expertise locally that they can use for having a business. Next slide. So here's a schematic of where we currently are with our design of just the preliminary experiments for getting to the end goal of having a system that can be in homes. So you can see here that it has a reactor, and we have two reactors, one where we're testing out where arsenic is already in the oxic, more easily removable form, and one where we're adding the arsenic in the reduced and harder to remove form. And we're pumping in currently artificial groundwater that mimics the groundwater as far as we can in the lab to what's in the local groundwater on the tribal lands. And then we have, we also put in other contaminants, the uranium and phosphorus, which can be a big issue in many different treatment systems. And then we pump it through and iron oxides form, which is this red color here. And then we collect the effluent and measure that over time. So this fraction collector can collect a sample every couple minutes. And so that's our current system. And through this, we'll be testing and developing this system over time and adding more and more of the components I spoke of previously. Next slide, please. And so this is just a picture of that cartoon model of what it really looks like in the lab. And with that, I'll hand it back to you, Anna.
Wonderful. Thank you, Steve. So now, as Steve mentioned, our center is very integrated. So leveraging the information that the Community Engagement Corps and the work they are doing, the geosciences projects are doing, we want to understand what are these exposures, what are the health effects in our communities. And for that, we are going in Project 3, we are going to look into an epidemiological study. And our hypotheses are that exposure to metals, in particular arsenic and uranium, have latent and concurrent cardiometabolic effects. And this is important because the latent effects are the ones that might be related to in utero exposures and might be persistent over time, even if you stop the exposure today. So this is why we want to really distinguish between the latent and the concurrent. And then we want to understand which are the pathways, which are the mechanisms that we can identify, especially the impact that these exposures might have on our DNA, DNA gene expression, impact on the DNA methylation, the epigenome, as well as the metabolomic signatures that might be a result of these effects. And so we plan on developing these multi-omic models to be able to look at those pathways and ultimately identify the metabolic and cardiovascular effects. So to do that, we are very privileged to leverage the Stronghart study, as we've mentioned, a very long-term cohort, which has data going on from the late 90s. And in the late 90s, for 10 years, a cohort of adults were followed. And later on, starting in the late 90s and early 2000s, the family study of the Stronghart study was initiated, which recruited family members, including the children of the original parents in the cohort. So leveraging the parents and the children already as adults, because the Stronghart family study recruited the children already as adults, and putting all of this information together, we want to study these latent and concurrent cardiometabolic effects of metals. And the new measures that we are going to be adding to the cohort is new data on DNA methylation for the children, because we don't have currently DNA methylation data in the family study, as well as more data on metals at the visit 5. This is an important visit because we know that in visit 5, the water system changed in many of our communities. The MCL for arsenic was implemented at that time, and that resulted in important exposure reductions in arsenic. So if you reduce the arsenic exposure because of these interventions that were set in place in community water systems, can you see reductions and benefits in cardiovascular disease? Or do you still see the lasting effects of the past exposures, both when they were younger, as well as from their parental exposures? So that's what we are aiming to do through our longitudinal design. And then through the effort going on in Project One, we are leveraging these water samples now used in obtained to check what is the exposure today in our communities. have we effectively reduced exposure? Are there still pockets of high exposures going on? And how this information is going to help us develop new models for assessing water exposure in the past. So this is our project 3. But as you know, many of you know, epidemiological studies are subject to multiple sets of biases, confounding, selection bias, measurement error. So we want to leverage an interdisciplinary approach and with an experimental study to look at the same research questions from a different angle. And mention that the Metalomics Core facility that we have with great ICP-MS, HPLC ICP-MS for the arsenic speciation, and the multi-collector ICP-MS to measure the metalomic isotopes is what's really allow us to do all of this epidemiological work at great sensitivity and specificity. And the data on the past exposures and the current exposures, we've already have some preliminary data for diabetes that makes it really compelling. And because we found that the maternal arsenic-related DNA methylation is associated with offspring insulin resistance, and that this association is attenuated for offspring adiposity, but not for maternal adiposity, kind of reflecting that maternal arsenic DNA methylation has influenced offspring adiposity. And so this is a core hypothesis that supports our project 3, and that we also want to test in an experimental design in our project 4. So in project 4, we are going to be evaluating the causal molecular mechanisms that link drinking water metal exposures to cardiometabolic disease, leveraging an animal model of early life pre-programming to look at the past early life exposures versus an animal model that continues with exposure throughout the life course to be able to look at the difference between early life only versus the long-term concurrent adult effects. And we follow a very similar model, but now under very controlled conditions where everything is carefully controlled. And we look at also at the multi-omics pathways and the cardiometabolic phenotypes. And so that you can look well at our experiments, we'll be able to compare the combination of arsenic and uranium versus arsenic alone or uranium alone to tap water. And we'll do that with combining these prenatal and postnatal exposures. This is modeling populations that have been exposed throughout their lifetime versus a population that could be exposed only prenatally. Maybe a population that was only exposed in the past prenatally, but where an intervention with treatment of water has now occurred. But as we were planning this work and the Superfund and the discussion with the community engagement and the communities, the big question was, how does the water in the lab compare to the well water that people are actually drinking? And this is something that has not been done previously. So together, again, leveraging the expertise of our geoscientists, the knowledge of the community to know which wells are contaminated and which wells we might be able to leverage, we are going to be bringing well water from the communities to our lab to be able to test and compare how does well water with high arsenic and high uranium, but with many other high levels for many other contaminants, how does that compare to the lab water and to the tap water in the lab? So this is what our project 4 is going to be doing. So with all of this work and our 5 projects working together, our community, and as well as our training core, which is an amazing group of leaders and trainees making everything possible, as well as our DMAC, our data management and analysis core, respecting tribal sovereignty, data sovereignty, and being extremely careful with all the data that we are collecting. We expect that in 5 years from now, we'll have developed predictions at a very fine scale, as Steve described, for arsenic and uranium, so that, for instance, drillers can decide where to go for low arsenic and uranium groundwater, and also for community water systems to decide which groundwater resources to use, because very often in our communities, a combination of surface water and groundwater is taking place for those community water systems. We also hope to be able to provide data on the distance the groundwater uranium is coming from. This is really important for our tribal partners. They really want to know how the mining is affecting their groundwater contamination. And we'll be able to do it for uranium, but for arsenic also, as Steve mentioned, because the uranium and selenium isotopes can actually help us predict where the arsenic is coming from. So this is really exciting and very new novel science.
Anna, sorry to jump in, but we're a little bit over time from the presentation standpoint. So if you wouldn't mind wrapping it up so we can get to questions.
Very good. Sorry for
this. You're on a roll. Sorry.
Thank you. Sorry for this. We are almost done. So yes, the epidemiological and data, and then hopefully we can launch this company that Steve mentioned. So we just want to really acknowledge the indigenous principles that motivate our work and partnerships, and also the study team and all the trainees that are not here in the picture, but they are here, and our external advisory committee members that include members from universities, as well as from the USGS and the Indian Health Service, which are really key partners for this, for our center. So with this, I am going to stop and we can take the questions. Sorry for taking a bit long. I got too excited.
That was a great presentation. Thank you, Anna, Steve, and Ray. That was really great. So we have questions coming in. As a reminder to the people that are listening in, please use the Q&A pod for your questions. The first question that came in, is lead being considered in your studies?
So thank you so much for that question. So we actually have data on lead in the SONAR study. Urinary lead is not a very good biomarker of lead exposure. That's the data that has been available. But with a collaboration with the CDC and ATSDR, we recently were able to measure blood lead in the SONAR study. So this is great because we are going to be able to look at lead too. And while lead mining, as far as I believe, is not occurring in our communities, we have data on, with a collaboration with the USGS, they did a water exposome study in collaboration with Missouri Breaks and investigators, including myself and others. And in that water exposome study, we actually found some lead in some of the water data in the tap water. So that will be an important question. So thank you. Yes, so we can study lead, yes.
Awesome. Thanks, Anna. The next question that came in was, thanks for these insightful studies. Is the incidence of cardiovascular disease mostly attributed to high levels of uranium and arsenic metals? Could there be other key factors?
Of course, there are many factors because cardiovascular disease is a very multifactorial disease with, of course, diabetes is playing a big role. But part of the diabetes could be related to metal exposures, of course, physical activity, diet, and many other factors. However, something I didn't have time to go into detail is that we want to develop a multi-omic fingerprint. And what that means is that with the multi-omic pathways related to arsenic and disease and diabetes and cardiovascular disease, we might be able to disentangle what part of the diabetes and cardiovascular disease epidemic is actually related to these metal exposures versus other general risk factors such as diet or physical activity. So this is something that we hope to be able to address in our study. And I didn't have time because I was already too long.
So the next question that came in is, great presentation, exciting work. Have you considered using any other isotopic signatures beyond light and heavy uranium and selenium isoscapes to help differentiate anthropogenic and naturally occurring uranium in groundwater? For example, the geochemist Earl Dixon has used life sulfur isotopes to fingerprint mine waste in Grant's Uranium District using a method that was developed for uranium deposits in the 60s.
So Steve, I let you answer that.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, the uranium isotope tracers also include uranium activity ratios, which help trace the sources. And then secondly, we are using the water isotopes. We actually see a very strong correlation between the water isotopes and the arsenic in the uranium in surface waters. And so that's going to also be very helpful. We have not currently planned to do the sulfur isotope work. Its sulfur isotope signature may be very similar in mining-related sources and natural sources because they might have the same genesis. So we weren't planning to do that in our work. Next question.
Thank you for the question. The next question is, on the Project 4 slide, how is the well water being compared? Is it an average of results?
So we are going to identify, that's a great question, because it's not going to be easy to do, as we cannot test, we would love to test multiple wells, but that would not be possible. So we are going to have to select a well that hopefully is representative of what people are drinking, but we are aiming to select a well that has quite high levels, as high as we can within the community. And the reason is because our animal model, of course, it's very short exposure, even though we are trying to do chronic exposure, but it's not exactly replicable with human exposures. So yeah, it's going to be one well, which hopefully reflects some types of average.
All right. Next question is, have you compared diabetes prevalence with other nations who may not be mining in areas such as the NYS Senecas?
So that's a great question. I think comparing, we have within the Stronghold study in the Oklahoma communities, I believe, I am not sure, I need to go check. I think the mining picture is different. So that would allow us to do some comparisons. Actually, we know the arsenic exposure and uranium exposure is much lower within our Oklahoma communities. So the Stronghold study in a way help us address that comment. But it will be interesting to be able to collaborate with other indigenous communities in the future. Yeah.
All right, we've got more coming in. So other regions such as India, Indonesia, South Africa are affected by high levels of naturally occurring metals. Have you established international collaborations with other mining regions and trying to leverage sharing of experience?
Steve, do you want to talk about the Bangladesh work? Maybe.
Well, I'll talk about various work, but first and foremost, one of our main collaborators is Henning Penning in Australia, and there's a lot of mining in Australia, so we have that. And then Ben Bostic has a number of international collaborations also in Asia, with a long-running projects in India, Thailand, Cambodia. We do have a lot of international work. The only one that I'm aware of that's specifically focused on mining, though, is the work in Australia.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for that. All right. The next question is, if iron is that low, some other issue, or sorry, it's a comment. If the iron is that low, some other issue is going on with the arsenic situation in your target area. Regarding multi-omics, what parameters are you focusing or suggesting from the omic studies?
So with the parameters that we are going to be using is the DNA methylation. That's the one for the epigenomics. And we are focusing on the metabolomics data. The metabolomics, we have two types of metabolomics data. We have one which is lipid-based lipidomics, and then we have the non-lipid-based platform. So all of this data will be integrated. We also have access to microbiome data, and actually this would provide some opportunities for inter-center collaborations with the University of New Mexico. As we can leverage, but the microbiome data actually is going to be, is ongoing. The data collection for the microbiome is going right now in the SONHAR study phase 7. So it's going to take a while for us to be able to access that.
Thanks, Anna. And then how many monitoring wells do you have at this moment? Are they under CERCLA site of investigation?
So we've done monitoring for more than 400 wells right now based on the Stronghold Water study and some of our previous collaborations, the collaboration with USGS that I mentioned earlier, as well as now the new sampling that Ray showed the picture with the new sampling going on, and they've already accomplished a lot of sampling in the last, the supplies, we need more supplies, we are learning because they, our team locally is so amazing that they've collected a lot of water samples already. But I don't know if they are under the CERCLA site of investigation. I'm not sure. Steve, do you know that? Answer to that question. Is that related to the quality control for the CERCLA? What does that
mean? No, I mean, we're not investigating a specific CERCLA site. We're working on in the tribal areas and but not specifically focused on any specific Superfund site.
Yeah, because there is the Superfund sites in our areas are a little bit further away, and so we are not looking into those Superfund sites particularly. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that. And with that, it's time to wrap up and move along to the closing of everything. Thank you again, Anna, Steve, and Ray. It was a great presentation. And thank you to the UNM folks as well, to Jose, Alicia, and Anjali. Thank you so much to all of you for the great work that you presented. And we're looking really forward to your research and throughout the next 5 years.
Thank you so much.
So I have a couple of concluding things, so please don't leave yet, everybody. So before we conclude, let's take a look at the seminar homepage. So this website will be active from today on, and it contains important resources, such as links to download the presentation materials, contact information for our speakers, should you have any other questions for them, and more information about the Superfund Research Program and a link to our feedback form. So we ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look to your comments. We try to continue to improve the content and delivery of webinars and of all of these things. So you can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. So under the related links tab on the webinar homepage, you'll also see a link to our newly released funding opportunity for our multi-project center grants, RFA ES23-001. We invite you to join us for the funding opportunities webinar related to that RFA release on May 15th. So to learn more about this and other funding opportunities, as well as information for SRP grants, please visit the SRP funding opportunities webpage. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure that you don't miss any future webinars. So for more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to the monthly newsletter TechDirect. We also encourage you to visit the SRP Progress and Research page to check out our monthly research brief as well, and subscribe to our Risky Learning listserv for more information about upcoming sessions. And you can also follow SRP on Twitter. So I'd like to encourage everybody to join us on May 12th and May 19th for the two remaining sessions in the series. In the May 12th session, we'll hear from three centers that are committed to environmental justice and emerging contaminants and in and amongst vulnerable communities. And then the fourth session, fourth and final, is about chemical exposures across the life course. So if you'd like to join the webinars, registration is filling up fast. We encourage you to register now. And if you can't attend the webinars, the recordings will be made available after the event. So with that, it's time to conclude today's session. Thank you all for your participation and for your great questions. And thank you to our presenters for the time spent preparing these and presenting today. So I hope you all have a great rest of your day. Thank you again for joining us, and please join the next two sessions.